From Acres USA, you are listening to this special edition of Tractor Time, a conversational podcast where we'll explore sustainable farming, regenerative practices, and the latest innovations in eco-agriculture with some of your favorite farmers and ranchers. I'm your host, Taylor Henry, the owner and CEO of Acres USA. Welcome to Tractor Time. Alrighty, so this is the Acres USA podcast. I'll do a little intro quick, Sam. Since early 2023, Acres USA has collaborated with OCIA through the support of the USDA Transition to Organic Program, TOP. We are thrilled to continue our partnership this year. Our joint efforts with OCIA encompass creating a range of white papers, webinars, and podcasts aimed at educating producers on various facets of transitioning to organic farming. Additionally, we provide on-farm events that offer local producers the opportunity to gain insights from pioneers and early adopters within their communities. Hello and welcome to today's Acres USA podcast. I'm Taylor Henry. I'm the new owner and CEO of Acres USA. And today I am joined by Sam Welsh, who works for OneCert Inc. in Lincoln, Nebraska, which is a certifier. Sam, would you like to introduce yourself, kind of give us a little background on how you got into the certification business and how that's treated you and what currently, what role you do and what role you play with OneCert?
Well, I got started in certification actually as executive director with OCIA over 20 years ago. I founded OneCert in 2003 and it's just been going from there. In 2005, OneCert, I went to India and formed a certification agency there that's known as OneCert International. They do a lot of work throughout Asia and Africa. And our focus here in our U.S. office is mostly in the United States and a little bit over the border. But we've just been trying to provide, you know, as clear and simple, straightforward certification as we can. It's sometimes seen as complicated, but we try to keep it simple without making it too simple, obviously. We need to cover all the bases, but not be excessive in doing so.
If you would expound on that a little bit more, what role do you see in the cog of organic production in America and the transition into organics? What are the certifiers' role? What is your role? And what do you think, you know, especially in the future here, what should certifiers focus on and what should their relationship look like with the producer?
Well, we're all accredited by the USDA to provide certification that complies with the Organic Foods Production Act and the USDA organic regulations. So, you know, in that sense, we are regulators, you know, making sure that there is compliance on the part of the farmers. But we also have an affinity for farmers. I grew up on a farm that was been organic since the early 1990s. So we wanted to provide our services in a way that's as user-friendly as possible. Our goal is to make sure that our operations we certify understand the rules, because if they understand them, it's easier to comply. And so I think that's we cannot be advocates in the sense that we can't be consulting or helping overcome barriers in a consulting type of role, but we can be educators in helping people understand what the regulations are and how that applies to their farm.
Got it. I think most certifiers I've spoken with seem to have a similar background where they're involved in some way in agriculture. Maybe they have a farm themselves. You know, they're passionate about this topic and it's another avenue for a job in this world. What type of organic farm did you grow up on?
Well, it was, you know, dryland farm in Nebraska that had livestock on it and range of crops, corn, milo, soybeans, alfalfa, oats, wheat. And my younger brother was the one who stayed on the farm and farmed with my father until, you know, he retired. He's still involved with a new tenant and of the family farm. So it's nice to see that that's still continuing.
Nice. And then what's kind of your coverage area? What do you focus on? Is OneCert, I'm assuming, is much broader than just Nebraska?
Oh, yes. We certify from Washington State to Florida and from Northeast U.S. to California. So we cover all that, a little bit into Mexico. And our international branch, as I said before, covers from South Pacific to Africa. So then throughout Asia and Middle East. We don't quite certify the world, but we do get to quite a few places.
Awesome. What's been the most rewarding thing for you starting this company and being in it for this long? How have you seen the waves change, and what's something that you can walk away with?
It's been interesting to see the changes, and there's always challenges because the regulations change. I think for us, you know, maintaining integrity, that we do as good a job as we can to make sure the operations we certify do actually comply with the regulations. We've uncovered a lot of instances of fraud along the way where people, you know, not necessarily among the operations we certify, but among those who they might be dealing with. So there's, I guess it's rewarding to uncover it and get it out of the system, because we want organic to be meaningful. I've been eating organic foods, oh gosh, for 40 years. It means something to me that when I buy organic, I want it to be organic. And I think that's what got a lot of people into it. And so I guess that's part of what's rewarding, just make a contribution to make sure there continues to be integrity in the organic certification world.
Absolutely. Speaking of fraud, there's one of the bigger changes this year in the organic certification is the new fraud prevention updates. Do you want to speak on that a little bit and maybe give a high-level overview of some of those topics and what's important out of that and what producers should worry about?
Right. A lot of it's already been a part of it. You know, the regulations have always had a rule that's kind of broad and encompassing. It's like, you know, as we're collecting information as a certifier, it can include things that are necessary to verify compliance. That's kind of a paraphrase of what's in the regulations. But the new SOE regulations simply get more specific about some of those aspects and require operations to be thinking about fraud and have a fraud prevention plan more explicitly than was in the past. It was kind of implied that, of course, that's necessary, but I think the USDA is now attempting to make that more explicit so that we actually get it included in the OSP and ask people to take, you know, to think about it and have a plan for preventing it. You know, if you want me to get into a few of the highlights of what a farmer might require in that, you know, unlike a trader who has multiple suppliers, sometimes dozens or hundreds of suppliers, farmers going to be more selective. They have suppliers for some of the inputs they might use, particularly seed. If they need some, you know, fertility inputs or pest control, you know, they want to make sure that all of those things comply. It's as much integrity protection as it is fraud prevention. So those two are almost interchangeable. But if you're buying, you know, if a livestock producer, for example, is buying feed, they want to make sure that whoever is bringing them that feed is actually still certified. We see instances all the time, you know, almost every month or more often, where somebody has provided a copy of a certificate, only that, and without telling them that after that certificate was issued, they've surrendered their certification or been suspended or revoked, and yet they're still trying to sell crops or other products with a certificate that's no longer valid. So one of the things that farmers need to do is, you know, monitor that, make sure that they are active. The new SOE rules requires that certificates be issued from the USDA database and website, and that certificate will include a link to the listing for the operation that's identified on that certificate. And so that provides a real-time way for anyone to check that link and make sure that the operation is still certified, because it will show their status. So that's a good tool to use. And, you know, there's been fraud in inputs where things that the base of it might have been, you know, a fish product or some other natural product that was allowed as fertility, but it was being spiked with chemical fertilizers. So those are things you can't always detect as a farmer, but, you know, just paying attention to when such products are removed, that, you know, they're making sure that those listings and approvals are still current. And that's what we do as a certifier also. We monitor the products that we've approved, and when we get notifications or discover that something's no longer allowed, we immediately notify our operators so that they're not going to continue to use something that may have been adulterated and is not actually compliant.
Yeah. So are organic certification agencies required to perform supply chain reviews and to verify from the farm through many handlers to final product that all are certified?
Yes. Well, we're always verifying, you know, at least one step back, that the supplier, if they are required to be certified, that they actually are. There are other cases where we do supply chain audits that those typically need to go through multiple certifiers and multiple steps and sometimes multiple countries. So those are a little more difficult to accomplish, but it's something we're working on putting in place. It's still, in some respects, a work in progress to how do we do that effectively, because it relies on so many different certifiers to verify each step in the chain. And it requires a good audit trail, something that's verifiable. And that's why, you know, record keeping is very important at every level.
Got it. Would you say that under the new SOE rules that the NOP now has any more enhanced enforcement capabilities?
I think even previously they had some enhancements from what it was originally, where they could do more in terms of enforcement, and I think even subpoena records, they have a little more access to require things, whereas before it was more voluntary. You know, a lot of it will depend on what the USDA chooses to do with some of that. Enforcement, you know, you can have the greatest rules and regulations in the world, but if it's not being effectively enforced, it really doesn't matter. And so that's why I, along with other certifiers, you know, continue to push the USDA to fully comply with the law and the regulations. I know we're not talking about hydroponics today, but the fact that USDA allows hydroponic operations to be certified is really a blatant violation of the law. And we're still working to get them to comply with the law, because organic obviously got its name from organic matter in the soil. The law requires that fertility come primarily from management of organic matter in the soil. So certification of hydroponics is just, on the face of it, a violation of that law.
So currently that they can be certified organic, but you would like to see that changed. How long ago did that happen?
Well, they don't. That started back in 2000, when they first started asking questions, were any certifiers certifying hydroponics? Now, even at that time, just asking the question, it's like, and the USDA at that time was saying they can only be certified if they comply with the law and the regulations. We thought, well, that's a nice way of putting it, but it means they cannot be certified because they literally cannot comply with the law or the regulations. You know, so that's an area. When you say they can be certified, there are people certifying it, but there's also those of us who would deny certification for such operations.
Got it. What else have you seen as kind of a gray area that you'd like to see?
I don't call that one a gray area, but there's certainly differences of interpretation of different parts of the rule. And since the law, one of the first purposes of the law is to provide a consistent standard, or, you know, establish standards, and then to assure consumers that there's consistency among this, how certification is done. There's some gaps in there, because there are things like greenhouses, mushrooms, beekeeping. None of those have standards, and yet they're being certified for over 20 years. Even though when the law first came out, the USDA stated that they knew those were things that needed to be, their additional rulemaking needed to be done in those areas. And they promised at that time to do it within the 18-month implementation period for what was at that time the new regulations. They failed to do that, and they're now over 20 years overdue to get those regulations published. And so those are all areas where anyone certifying those types of products has no standard to do so. So there is no consistency in how it's being done. They are... Go ahead.
What would you say is causing this? Is it people that make these decisions, put these laws in place, that don't fully understand the process? Or is it something else that's causing this?
Well, I think there's a large element of politics involved. and influenced by those who have money and influence to keep, to either prevent things from being certified or to allow things to be certified that do not comply.
Interesting. When does this new regulation become effective? Is it in March?
March 19th is the last day that an uncertified handler could sell organic products. So on, as of March 20th, that was intended to stop. Just a couple weeks ago at training with the USDA, however, despite, having over a year to implement the SOE regulations, and despite the major effort that the USDA and certifiers are making to inform operations that were previously not required to be certified, that they are now required. So a lot of brokers, traders, importers, certain types of distributors, they're all required to be certified now. And it was supposed to happen as a deadline was supposed to be March 20th. Well, so many of them have procrastinated and not done so that now we have a fuzzier deadline. It's still a deadline, but now the question is, how do we enforce that when the USDA is saying, well, as long as people have applied by that time, we'll give them a grace period to get certified. Well, in most things in the U.S., in the regulations, you do have deadlines. If you want to certify your, if you want to get certified for your land, you have to go through a 3-year transition period, not a 2-year and 364-day transition period. It has to be at least 3 years. So there's no room on that. In terms of livestock rules, origin of livestock and the first third of gestation, or, it has to be under organic management from the first third of gestation. Those are hard and clear cutoffs. Now, with the USDA being more fuzzy about when it's going to start enforcing these new rules for operations that are not certified, not currently certified, but are required to be certified, creates some ambiguity and difficulties for certifiers. And how do we verify that somebody's getting product from an operation that's, not currently certified, but has applied for certification? And we're struggling with that. So, yeah. And how that happens is yet to be determined.
Is there any pesticide or GMO testing currently that are required of imported grain labeled as organic?
Well, it's not specifically for imported, but it's required for all products. There's a certain percentage that we're expected to sample and test every year. And that our focus should be on those that are higher risk. And certainly, as we've shown, a lot of inputs are high risk. But I should point out that there's a lot of domestic fraud going on as well. All of the fraud is not foreign. You remember the case about Randy Constant, who was based in Missouri and had operations, farms in Nebraska as well. That was $140 million fraud that he was convicted of. There may have been even more. So there's a tremendous amount of fraud that can happen domestically as well. And we know there's other cases that are still being investigated and may also come to, court convictions.
What was the, you want to give an overview of what the case was about with Randy Constant?
Sure. He was, and this was one of the ones that we had identified and reported almost 10 years before he was convicted in court of fraud. So we knew what he had been doing is selling conventional crops as organic. And it was first discovered, I think, around 2008, when some of that tested positive for GMOs. But he said, they always came up with excuses, and it wasn't their fault. But he switched to sourcing non-GMO grain and using that as and selling that as organic. And there are others involved in this kind of trade too. And one of the ways he was successful is he manipulated the timing of inspections so that it was, the corn would be taller You couldn't see as far into the field, so the edges of the fields were not sprayed, but they were using herbicide in the center of the fields. Mm-hmm. Or just, he had even arranged for a kind of transloading where he had an elevator, you know, he'd bring in non-GMO and it would go out organic. Truckers knew it was happening, but it took a long time for the USDA and I think even the FBI got involved to gather enough evidence that they could get a conviction. So
that's very interesting.
Yeah, I know of other cases too. It's not uncommon for that, for fraudsters to use that strategy, that they'll buy non-GMO or something that won't test positive, and then they'll take it, you know, on rail cars or trucks, and they'll transload it, and it magically becomes organic.
Magic organic train ride.
Right.
Core of how he was caught was through testing. Originally, the first...
That was the first indication that there was a problem that was with... There was also, you know, the... I don't recall all the details of it, but when it started to be audited more closely, where the numbers didn't add up, if you had a 100 acres that was certified, but you were selling what could only have been grown on 1,000 acres, you know, it's like the proverbial loaves and fishes, you know, where it keeps multiplying. So a little bit of organic became a lot organic. And that's where the USDA is now going to be requiring acres to be reported on every operation, so that it's going to be a little easier to check to see if the volume that they're selling could have been grown on the number of acres that they have certified.
Yeah.
And
now what if someone, there's obviously chains in this whole situation.
Right.
So what if someone sells their crop to a broker, say a grain or a fruit, do they need to make sure that that processor or the broker sells to is certified as organic? And what would you recommend to a producer that's getting started? How do they make sure that the person that they're sending their product to is following these rules?
Well, as a, you know, organic farmer is probably going to be most interested that they're getting an organic price for their crop, whether it's coming from somebody who's certified organic or not. And even the USDA has told certifiers, you know, we can't enforce who crop is being sold to. You know, it does create some red flags. And if we suspect that someone is not certified in the supply chain that should be, I've been asked to report that to the USDA. But it's really not the farmer's responsibility or even the elevator's responsibility to make sure that their buyers are maintaining certification. However, I'd put one big caveat there. If you're selling something on a contract and you want an organic price for it, just like, you know, selling any large commodity, you want to make sure that the buyer is bonded, or, you know, you have some guarantee of getting paid for that. You know, there's been too many cases in the organic world and even conventional where a company goes bankrupt and they're not able to pay for the grain that's been delivered. And so that's beyond my ability to provide good advice to, but I can certainly point people to good resources for that.
Yeah. From the farmer perspective, what would you say, you know, I think a lot of concern that we've heard is, you know, here's more regulations, here's more things that we have to do, another set of rules that we need to follow. What do you say to the people that are just concerned that, hey, now I'm going to have more paperwork, more stuff to track, and, you know, they're already busy as it is?
Yeah, I think you know, any honest farmer is probably keeping enough records to verify compliance. It's the ones creating fraud that have more work to do to create fictitious records, fake records.
Yeah.
And I've never seen a disadvantage to a farmer for keeping good records, because if you have good records of your production and you are able to look at that over the years, it helps you make better farming decisions. So good records per se, I think, are good for farming, and especially for organic farming. There's the old joking question about what's the most important equipment on an organic farm. It used to be the file cabinet. These days it's the computer, wherever you keep your records.
Yeah. So with record keeping, it's kind of a broad, that's a broad subject in itself, right? Where a record could be, you know, I have a mapping software on my phone called Onyx that if I go and work with a field or do something, spread seed, mow, I'll just turn my tracker on, my GPS tracker, and it'll track my movements, and then I'll be able to go back, stop a track, label what I did that day, and then it's, in theory, that's a record, right?
Right.
It's has a date. It has exactly the GPS coordinates where I was. You put the type of seed and the type of whatever you did on that field that day. What are some other things that you've seen farmers maybe leverage some technology in the last few years to help with the time of keeping records? And if there's anything that you've seen people have some success with to get some of their time back and help with that record keeping.
Well, even that kind of technology is only as good as our ability to understand it. Because it used to be you could go out and you'd have to look in the shoebox or the glove box to find all the records. It wasn't well organized.
Yeah.
And some of the electronic systems I've seen is the equivalent of an electronic shoebox. You've got all the records, but they're still not organized in a way that makes them easy to audit and understand. And that's the real key. You know, it's not just collecting records, it's keeping them organized in a way that's possible to audit and understand what activities took place on the farm. So whatever record keeping system somebody has, it should be possible for a third party to look at that and know, you know, with some real, you know, degree of confidence that they can tell what happened on that farm or in those fields. We want to be able to see what seed was planted, you know, if there was any compost applied or other inputs applied. We want to see, you know, what quantities were applied, when they were applied, who applied them. And then when the harvest comes, you know, where did that harvest go? Was it put in a bin? Was it sold straight from the farm, hauled to an elevator? You know, all those details just need to make sense so that we can quickly see, okay, you planted a certain amount of seed. That was enough seed to grow a crop of so many bushels. That many, however many bushels were harvested. Where did it go? What was sold? So everything should flow in a nice, organized, logical fashion. So if it makes sense to the inspector, you know, it should make sense to the farmer. And I'm not sure what else to say about that. It's record keeping is important, yeah. But I've seen many effective systems, and I've seen some that are not so effective. And
And all that gets kind of organized and planned in the plan that each farmer makes with their certifier that
right.
year.
They need to just describe how they keep records and where they keep records.
Does a farmer need to submit a new organic system plan for applications every year, even when they continue with the same certification agency?
Well, I'm not sure how every agency does it. They're required to submit an annual update form every year describing what changes they've made to their system or to their organic system plan. We actually don't ask people to fill out the form from scratch. You know, if we make any changes to an organic system plan, we'll transcribe the information they had on the old form onto the new form. So all they have to do is review any new questions or update the old answers to make sure everything is still current. So, you know, we just want it to be updated. We don't require a new one to be submitted every year.
Okay. Is there anything else that you can think of? So we have a list of questions that folks had asked during the webinar with Harry at Bihar. We didn't get to all of them, so I think it'd be good to run through those same questions with you and get your response, and maybe you have a different perspective than Harriet. But is there anything else before we get into that on the topics that we've discussed that you think is important to mention?
Oh, I can't think of anything specific. The main thing is to, you know, start early. You know, if you're somebody who's wanting to get certified for the first time, make your contacts with the certifier during the years you're in transition so that you can make sure that the things you're doing are going to be certifiable at the end of that 3 years. And we do our best to make a high priority whenever somebody wants to use a new input that we review that and get that, you know, thumbs up or thumbs down so they know right away if that's going to be allowed, because we don't want people taking the risk of applying something that their neighbor said was okay or the salesman said was okay. We want to verify that for people so that they can use those inputs with confidence that that's not going to be a risk to their organic integrity. And like I said, then just keeping records of what they're doing in the fields, you know, how much they harvest, where that harvest goes. You know, people come in and say, well, you said you harvested this much. You know, you should have records to show that you sold that much and not more than that.
Yeah.
Okay. With this process that you've outlined, we've talked about, will it cause more work for the farmer? Probably not. You think record keeping is important, and staying on top of those things is positive for all parties. Right. But do you think it'll have an effect at all with the organic products being more price prohibitive just because of the extra work that it's causing to certify?
Well, certainly there's more work for us in terms of auditing, and there's increased expectation that we do more testing. And currently the law and the regulations require certifiers to pay for that testing out of their pocket. We can't charge it back to the people we certify. I guess it's, you know, costs go up, travel costs go up. There's so much that goes into the expense of it. And you hope the prices are staying up there. You know, unfortunately, I think, you know, there's swings in the prices for organic, just like there are cycles in the conventional pricing. Mm-hmm. And we do our best to verify that the things being sold as organic are truly organic, which should result in better prices for those who are honest organic farmers. And if we can detect and get those who are committing fraud out of the system, then that should be good for those who are left.
Right.
And that's a cost that, you know, as the fraudsters get more clever, we have to try to keep up with that. You know, it's hard to be a step ahead of them, but we like to think we're maybe not too many steps behind.
Yeah. Yep. All right. Here's an interesting question. This came from someone on the webinar. I've thought about going organic when we start up our raw milk dairy. I'm interested in the balance between animal welfare versus organic. We had a dairy cow punctured her foot 2 years ago and had to have an abscess drained, and our vet treated her with a course of antibiotic. Obviously, there would have been a withdrawal period after the antibiotic, but beyond the withdrawal period, how long would that cow have to be out of the organic cohort?
It can never be organic again. Once it's been treated with antibiotics, it's out. But there is a requirement. You can't avoid, you know, if antibiotics are necessary for the, you know, health and life of an animal, they need to get those. But it does mean that they're out of the organic production system.
But they could cycle her back as a brood cow and have...
Well, not for organic dairy.
Okay. But you think for a beef production, would she be able to drop a calf?
Yeah, no, she would never be organic meat, but as long as everything from the last third of gestation is organic. Now, it's been I say this with the caveat that you should actually talk to someone who's currently reviewing livestock files day to day, which I'm not doing right now. So I'm doing my best to give you a good answer, but you know, nobody should go and say, well, I heard Sam say this on the Acres podcast, and said, no, you should talk to your certifier and make sure that what you're planning to do is going to be acceptable.
That's the caveat with everything. Talk to your certifier.
That's right.
Yeah.
And
Go ahead.
I was only going to say that, and hopefully it doesn't matter which certifier you're talking to, you should get the same answer.
Right. What can be a reasonable expectation from the consumer in the USDA organic certification with the use of chemicals, GMOs, and soil fertility?
Well, that's kind of a broad question.
Yeah.
I
would say, you know, how can they use chemicals? I would assume they mean making sure that we get GMOs out. And then do you see anything coming down the pipe where soil fertility comes into?
Well, I think certainly we've approached it that soil and the management of organic content of the soil is the core of what it means to be organic, and that's what's required. For a crop to be grown organically, it needs to be grown in soil, and that only the allowed inputs are what's being grown there. The other chemicals, there's a very short list of things that are not natural that can be allowed in organic production, and that list seems to be getting smaller. So that's one assurance, and we do testing. You know, not every product, that'd be prohibitive to do all crops, but we do enough of them, and we try to target those where the risk is highest to assure that there is not contamination. And anything that tests positive, that where we find a chemical residue, cutoff is pretty low, even for unavoidable kind of contamination that might come in with even rainfall. You can detect chemicals in the rain. The wind blows, you can have, dust from another farm coming in. There's a just drift in the air. If anything is detected that's more than 5% of what's allowed in a conventional product, it cannot be sold as organic. So that's a big part of the protection, I think, in terms of chemicals. And GMO is just strictly prohibited. You can't use GMO seed to grow an organic crop.
Got it.
How have you seen the other certification programs and labels for, say, regenerative agriculture or the Real Organic Project relate to what you guys do? Are they tied to the USDA organic certification in any way? And in particular, all the discussion on regenerative agriculture is very confusing from the consumer's perspective.
Sure. Before I got into organic, I was involved with the Nebraska Sustainable Agriculture Society and attended some of the early work and education we did through the university and other groups supporting sustainable agriculture. It was a way of supporting organic, but also, like I remember Bob Rodale back in the, I'll date me here, it's probably 1980s, early 90s, talking about regenerative even back then. And I think even, the terms like sustainable and regenerative, in my mind, are more values that the farmer or the consumer has. It's not that there's a set of practices that make a farm sustainable. It's really the goals and the way people monitor the results of what they're doing to see if it's going to be sustainable. And I think I'd put regenerative in the same thing. You're trying to improve things with soil, and it's not something you can reduce to a set of practices where you do this, you don't do that. Even organics that way, it's got some basic guidelines in terms of it requires crop rotation and all the things I'm forgetting right now that are in the regs. There's a certain set of practices and methods that are expected and required, but it's how the farmer puts those together on their operation that really makes it work. There's no recipe that's going to be applicable to all places. Yeah. So it is, it's like consumers are still like the word natural, but there's absolutely no regulation on what the word natural means, except in some very narrow examples. And so there's a certain element of it that's marketing, and a certain element that really represents something real. And I guess that's why I'm still working in organic. I think having the types of regulations we do, and having people with integrity working in the certification area, it makes that a meaningful label. You mentioned the Real Organic Project. We've been working with them for many years, and this year, we're offering through our inspectors and our staff, if somebody wants the Real Organic logo on top of the organic one, they can do that with one cert, and there's no additional cost for that. I guess it's maybe always been a free label for farmers, but it's easy, or it's something we've worked closely enough with them, and you can apply with us. We'll do the verification for them. It's kind of a seamless process.
Got it. Something I think with your background and how you guys certify, something that's interesting. Is there any other countries that issue certification that's equal to USDA organic certification?
Well, yes, and some have been officially recognized, like there is equivalency agreements between the U.S. and Europe, between the U.S. and Japan. There's some recognition agreements with several countries like New Zealand, Israel. You know, there's a longer list than what I have and than I can recite right now. But there are some equivalent, and doesn't mean they're identical, but it means they're close enough to be this same thing.
Got it. Is there anything else that you think is important for our audience to be aware of, know about, anything that we missed on this episode?
I'm sure there is. We've had less than an hour.
Yeah.
I've been doing this 20 years and I'm still learning things. So I'd say the main thing is just to start to build those connections with other organic farmers and with your organic certifier. And it's a great path to learn. And if there's anyone listening who is not yet made the decision to farm organically, even when we were working in the sustainable ag area and helping people make that transition, it's important to recognize that it is, as many people said, it's as much a change in thinking as it is a change in practices, because you need to think about it as you're managing a biological system and not managing chemical inputs. So if you're making that switch from conventional to organic, you're managing a different type of system. And you know, that's probably why those who first wrote the rules said it there should be a 3-year transition period, because it may take that long to start to understand the important aspects of another system.
How would you encourage folks to get through that 3-year process?
Well, I think working with another, some type of mentor, whether it's through an organization or a neighbor, somebody who can help you understand or get through that. And I know there are some funds out there to help with those kind of programs these days. The USDA is putting a lot of energy toward that and a lot of money toward that.
Got it. All right, Sam, anything else you'd like to discuss? If not, we can probably wrap this up and another great episode talking about organic transitioning sponsored by the OCIA.
No, this is great, and congratulations to you and your new endeavor there at Acres. It's nice to see it.
Thank you.
Continuing. So.
Thank you. I appreciate it. How long have you been following Acres?
Oh, probably since I was a teenager.
That's awesome.
Yeah, and that was over 50 years ago. I imagine Acres is at least that old, if my memory isn't failing.
Yep, just over 50 years. Yep. Yeah. We'll have our 50th Acres Eco Ag Conference next year. So I think that's one of the biggest things folks will talk about, is how they went to those conferences with their dad or when they were a kid.
And yeah.
So I'm fortunate. I feel fortunate being able to lead the organization and take over something with such a long track record and positive authority.
So when did you first hear about it?
I first heard about it when I first decided I wanted to buy a farm. I was actually into land through hunting, and I knew I wanted to buy land and get into land ownership. I liked just the management of land just through hunting. I opened a book called Restoration and Agriculture by Mark Shepard and went down the rabbit hole and was officially bit by the bug. Mm-hmm. Mark was only 20 miles from where I'm at, so he's been a little bit of a mentor to me, and I had a marketing agency and some other businesses that I gained some good experience that helped me be prepared for a business like this. And that's how we came to this venture.
Well, that's a good way to be introduced to it. Yeah. And certainly
farming
is, I think back when I was younger and the, you know, just the amount of wildlife, the pheasants that we used to see much more commonly, it's a difference. You have this kind of clean agriculture today. It doesn't give much habitat for a lot of the game birds and others that were much more abundant at one time.
Yeah, it goes both ways, because although I would never trade it for anything in the world, but I have a beef cattle operation where we rotationally graze cattle, and I have an abundance of birds, mice, insects, but also groundhogs that will bury themselves. They must have a giant tunnel system throughout the pasture. But now they're starting to pop up in my sheds. So I said, we've made the soil and the environment around here so healthy that everything feels really welcome. But I'd appreciate it if they didn't dig up through my sheds and ruin my floors. But it is part of it.
Yes, part about nature. It finds a way.
It does. It does. And it gives back. it gives back. I think right now in our area, Mother Nature's paying us back because of we went through a tough drought last summer, which we're borderline in danger of doing the same, but we've been blessed with, from a grazing perspective, a lot more time to graze this summer. Mm-hmm. And we had, you know, pretty good rains at the end of fall in October, November, and we got a decent rain this past week, so it's still dry. I don't know, how are you still dry in your area as well?
Well, I don't think there's ever been a, you know, it would be rare for us to say we've got enough rain, it should stop.
Yeah. I know, I'm probably complaining too much. Our area has better precipitation than Nebraska. It's the dance with nature. There's no question about that.
Yeah, just recognizing, you know, it's hard to say you're really managing a natural world, or you do what you can, but nature has its own plans sometimes.
There's no question about that. We just got to sit there, and that's why I always refer to it as a dance, because you're trying to be proactive in some ways, but you can't really be with nature all the time. So,
well, it was good to meet you and good to have this discussion.
Absolutely.
I hope we can do it again sometime.
Absolutely, Sam. Thank you very much. Right. We appreciate
sure thing.
It.
Sure thing.
Thank you for listening to Tractor Time, a podcast production of Acres USA. Find us on Spotify, Apple, Google Play, and other popular podcast platforms. Find other Acres USA media and learn about Acres USA events at acresusa.com. We'd like to thank Acres USA staff for their contributions to producing this podcast. This episode was edited and engineered by Kennedy Strosol of Acres USA. We're grateful to our guests for taking the time to talk with us about their experiences.